Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you, Denis, and thank you, everybody, for the opportunity to share some of my thoughts with you. What I'd like to do today is to, being the first speaker of these long and interesting sessions, I'd like to give you a perspective on the human embryo, because sometimes when we talk about models, we forget that behind them there is an embryo, and how the image of the human embryo has changed over the last 150 years from an element of curiosity to one of study to nowadays one that it's approaching a dystopian view of the world and of human nature. I will also be filling in a little bit for my colleague Naomi Morris that was going to talk about gastroloids, and as Denis has suggested, I'll give you some thoughts. I will not do it as well as she would have, but I will try. So, what is an embryo? I'm going to give you a few seconds so that you all work out in your mind an answer. You know, even some of us who have worked with embryos of many different species for a very long time would find it very difficult to pinpoint what exactly is an embryo. I sometimes feel that it is like that American judge who was asked, "What is pornography?" And he said, "I don't know, but I can tell you when I see it." And I think in a way that's what happens with embryos. When we see them, we point out what is an embryo. But if we ask what is the definition of an embryo, we would find it a bit difficult. Even as I say, those that work with them all the time. I've done this exercise with students and with colleagues, and it's not easy to come to some kind of an arrangement and a definition. When you think that you have reached some comfortable position in trying to define what is an embryo, which often I should say is not what we do. We work with embryos. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about definitions. But when we put all of a sudden the adjective human in there, everything is thrown into some kind of disarray. And if you go out and ask what is a human embryo to people and to our colleagues, you will find a very wide variety of definitions and discussions. And it is that when we put the term human in front of anything, we are not speaking anymore to our colleagues, but we are speaking to a very wide audience. And I'm sure this afternoon we shall have an interesting discussion on the implications of that. And that's a big difference when we think about the biology. The biology of the human touches upon a lot of situations and elements of our lives and our intellect that are much, much broader than science. One of the issues with the human embryo is that it's hidden. It's hidden, and it's been hidden for a very, very long time. In fact, whereas subjects like physics have been going on for hundreds of years, our understanding and our study of human development and of human embryos is very recent. We've only been thinking about human embryos for about 100 years, more or less. And part of that is this hidden element. Until the late 1800s, human embryos were an object of curiosity. People were much more concerned with what they used to call ensoulment, what was a human being, what was the soul, rather than with the actual biological object. They did not consider a human embryo as a biological object. It is in the 1800s when a lot of studies start appearing about embryos of different animals that people start thinking that maybe a human embryo should be treated like any other embryo. And that happened, as I said, towards the end of the 19th century. Until then, people collected human embryos. In fact, some of them you can find here in the museum in the Jardin des Plantes. You will find some very spectacular specimens. These ones that you see here are from the Hunterian Museum in London. And if you go there, you will find a lot of interesting oddities. They were oddities. I think what was coming out from spontaneous abortions, miscarriages, a lot of situations, they were very, very odd things. And doctors kept them in collections of oddities, and with very few exceptions, they were not thinking about what did tell us about a human being or about human development. The first person to deal with this subject was Wilhelm Hess, who towards the end of the 19th century decided that a human embryo should be an object of study, And he decided, as it was at the time, to create a table of normal development, because in that collection that you saw of miscarriages, that many of them had pathologies that now we can identify, it was very difficult to know what was normal development and what was abnormal. Wilhelm Hiss, as some of you know, was a very important contributor to many aspects of developmental biology. In particular, he was the one that invented the microtome, and it allowed him to, for the first time, create three-dimensional representations of embryos. But he had a very, very important role in creating a table of normal development with his work that it's illustrated in that. And the way he did it was to work with midwives and doctors, and in fact, it's interesting that he threatened them. He wanted them to give him the specimens that they had so that he could study them, and he threatened them very simply. He said, if you don't give it to me, you don't know what is normal and what is abnormal. If you want to publish it, I will criticize you. If you give it to me, I will give you some credit. In fact, he starts a very interesting trend, which is not very good, and you will find, if you read human embryology, that the credit that he gave to the doctors is that he would name the embryos by the doctor, not by the woman that they came from, and this creates some problems. The work of Wilhelm Hiss was continued by Franklin Moll in what is known today as the Carnegie Collection. This is a very large collection of embryos. To me, the most valuable part of the collection is the embryonic part, not the fetal part. And this is where some boundaries that I'm sure we'll talk this afternoon come into being. An embryo is transformed into a fetus at about 8 weeks. The embryo is the construction of the structure of the organism. The fetus, in general, is the growth. Everything starts with an egg. And an egg is a very small thing. An egg is like an egg, like any other egg, as you can see there. And the human egg, it's small because it's shed most of the yolk. It has yolk. It is the biggest cell that we have in our body. But still, it's very small compared to eggs that are more familiar with, that are more. And when it's fertilized with sperm, it will give rise to the embryo and eventually to a newborn. Very important from the point of view of research is that during the earlier stages after fertilization, the embryo is free-floating in the uterus and is looking for a place to implant after fertilization. And this free-floating ability until the moment of implantation, that in the case of the humans happens after a week, will allow, as you will see, to researchers in the 20th century, not only to deal with it as an object of biology and learn, but also to create treatments for people with infertility. After a week, the blastocyst, this structure is called the blastocyst that you can see there, after 7 days it finally implants, and after implantation it will start developing the growth. This is, to me, many people don't know what a human embryo. This is from work of Bernadette de Backer in Amsterdam, who has runs the Dutch Fetal Biobank, which is a very, to me, probably right now the most interesting place to think about human embryos in Europe and certainly in the world. That's a cast that she made of embryos, of human embryos, at different weeks. That's what you can see. The number reflects different weeks, and it's absolutely to scale. I've put it next to a dime and a euro so that you can see that even at the time that the embryo is transitioning into a fetus, that you can see there between 7 and 8 weeks, it's still smaller than a dime. I think this is something that sometimes we don't appreciate, that they are very, very small, these objects. You can see this embryo will fit in a dime, and that gives you an idea of the scale. This is an embryo about 6 weeks. It's 3 millimeters, and by 8 weeks, everything is laid down there, everything. You have the limb buds coming out. You have the face in the process of construction. Everything is laid out, and then it will come what people call the fetus. So an embryo is a really small thing. We've come a long way. I mean, this is Bernadette does a lot of tomography. That's the yolk sac. For those of you who are interested, there you can see the spinal cord and the somites, and you can see also some of the limb buds in there. Over the next, since the time of the Carnegie Collection, since the time of Frank Moll, and things have changed a great deal. And particularly, for example, based on the Carnegie collection, Bernadette and her colleagues have been constructing three-dimensional structures. We've come into scanning EM. And then, as you will see, Alain Chedotal, who will be talking this afternoon, has created very important renditions, mostly of fetuses, but allowing us to see all the beauty. This now has become in a totally deconstructed view. Embryos are only subject to modern techniques like single-cell RNA-seq, and even as a spatial transcriptomics. So we've seen a very long development of the embryo from the scientific point of view in a trip that starts with Wilhelm Pies. So this is the site of the embryo that is the object of a scientific quest and a scientific curiosity. However, in the 60s, until the 60s, I mean the 1960s, this is all the embryo. People don't worry very much about embryos. In fact, there is no boundary between the science and the public, and you will find many publications about embryos in magazines and even in some books. But in 1968, something happens, and it's the publication of this article in the Life magazine by Leonard Nielsen, of what he calls a child is born, the drama of life before birth. The 60s coincide with a lot of changes in public attitudes, particularly in the States towards abortion. And these images, which Nielsen produced first in this article of Life that some of you might have seen, and later in a book, which was very influential, these images were taken by the anti-abortion movement, and then embryos, and a lot of the book has to do with embryos, and mostly fetuses, but he also has some embryos, it becomes an icon. All of a sudden, these kind of pictures are transformed the human embryo from an object of study to an icon of social and political movements. One interesting thing about these pictures, which were presented as photographs taken inside the womb and of live embryos, most of them, with the exception of one or two, they are stage pictures of dead fetuses. And this is something that sometimes is not pointed out enough. Because, of course, what the anti-abortion movements want to present you is the embryo as a free entity, free of the mother, as autonomous entity, that if you're going to do abortion, that's not right, because you're keeping something that can live on its own, which of course is not the case. But I don't want to dwell on that. What happens then is that, of course, that leads to a question that we've been asking for a long time, and that brings back to the question, what is a human embryo? And the reason that we have to think about this is because this connection with the society, and it's unfortunate, but or fortunate if you wish, is it that the human embryo is any different from any other embryo? Not from the scientific point of view, but we do have to think about it because if we don't, people can take advantage of the lack of definition and the lack of positioning. So when you're working with humans, you are in a very difficult position. So usually people define an embryo, a human embryo, as an entity resulting from the fertilization of a human egg inside the uterus. And this has been a definition for a very long time. Until, of course, comes Dolly. And Dolly transforms because, of course, Dolly does not fit this definition. Dolly is not the product of fertilization of an egg, of a mammal, and happening in the uterus. And that leads to new definitions that you can see here. And then you just transform. This is the Court of European Justice in the case of that, and now it's extending. I should say that many countries still keep this definition, because indeed, the whole idea, different countries have different definitions of an embryo. Why is this important? Because this determines how you can work with human embryos, right? Surprisingly, France has no definition of what is a human embryo. Why should we care? I mean, this is a very important thing. Well, many of you will have heard that fertility is declining all over the world. That and this is a map of fertility in the world. This is not just the plots. The time to conceive is getting later. There is a lot of problems with pregnancy tests. So we do need to try to understand not only the embryo, but where the embryo comes from, because we want to address these issues. If we are somehow different from animals, is that for human beings to have a child is probably the most important way of living a trace in the earth. And of course, there is a lot of emotional values attached to that. In the 60s and the 70s, this man, Bob Edwards, decided to tackle this problem, and he started to study the mechanism of oocyte maturation towards fertility, and he did very important work of this. But of course, many of you will know Bob Edwards because his work on the mechanism of oocyte maturation led him to try to develop in vitro fertilization. And in vitro fertilization is another sort of way of looking at human embryos. And I'm always very surprised that we have this separation of developmental biology and reproductive biology, because when you read the history of in vitro fertilization, what you realize is that that's not the history of a technology, but the history of a very important and interesting side of developmental biology, of human developmental biology. Because one of the things that Edwards and his colleagues took advantage of is the fact that during the first week of development, the fertilized embryo is free until it implants. And therefore, you can do a lot of things of it. Once you develop conditions to work with them, you can do that in vitro. And here is the product of the toilings. It's the in vitro fertilization. This is sometimes forgotten, that actually people think about in vitro fertilization with Bob Edwards and Patrick Steptoe, but this lady here, which is Jane Purdy, was a very, very important person in the team. She was a nurse that was hired by Bob Edwards to work on the development of in vitro fertilization. And in fact, she is the one that did all the work, and she died very young. But here there are the three together, and I think we should make clear that the work of in vitro fertilization was the three of them. How did they know that they had obtained in vitro fertilization? And to me, this is what must have been remarkable, is because they saw the egg becoming an embryo, dividing many times and forming a blastocyst. And to me, this paper is one of the most iconic and important papers of the history of developmental biology, because the techniques that they developed ushered in and opened the possibility of doing developmental biology with humans. This is, of course, Louis Brown, that was the great celebration. And today we have a very large collection that has become a technique. This is a movie today. In vitro fertilization has become a routine technique. This is a picture from a movie from the lab of Jean-Léon Maître here in Paris. And in fact, we still don't understand very well in vitro fertilization, because the rate of success in vitro fertilization is not great. It's not very different from the natural world, which is about 1/3, 30%. And these days, people are trying to figure out which embryos to implant. And one of the ways they do it is by filming the embryo as it develops before implantation, and trying to correlate the features that happen in the embryo with the success of in vitro fertilization. Of course, this opened, which is what Jean-Léon is very good at, a lot of possibilities of understanding a lot of the events that are happening early on. It also opens commercial possibilities, because the clinics sell pictures like this to the parents as this was your child, but that's a totally different situation. So, today, more than 8 million IVF births have been developed since 1978. But of course, the question arose at the moment this technique, that's when all of a sudden basic research became a technique. So the question was immediately, if you could grow these embryos in vitro until the implantation moment, I mean, how far can we go? How far should we go? You're looking at something that happens almost 40, 50 years ago. And at that time, everything was possible. And the idea of ectogenesis, that is the generation of human beings outside of the womb and the growth of them, was not a far-fetched thought. The response of this was in the UK to create a committee that it's called, was presided by Mary Warnock. And they spend a great deal of time trying to think how to deal with this. Sometimes it is misunderstood what the object of the Warnock Committee was. It was not to try to define when is the beginning of life, or when does a human being come into light. Their remit was much more constrained and much more simple. It was to try to define a moment where this entity that had been created in a dish would deserve legal protection. Of course, that's associated with a number of features of a human being and an embryo, but they were not interested in discussing this. In fact, the committee was very varied, was headed by Mary Warnock, who was a philosopher, who had some experience in issues of ethics. And out of 15 or 16 people, there was only one biologist, and that was Anne McLaren. And it was Anne McLaren who suggested that moment in which that entity was to be subject to legal protection is the beginning of gastrulation, which starts at day 14. And that led to the day 14 rule. Why is that? Because at that moment, the primitive streak, which is the structure that defines gastrulation and defines the anteroposterior axis of the embryo, determines the individual. If you separate the blastocyst into two, you're going to get two individuals. After gastrulation, what you would get is Siamese twins, which is something that, as you know, is difficult to decide if it is one or two people. But they decided that really, if you wanted to grow these fertilized embryos in vitro, you should stop at day 14, because at that moment, whatever is grown, it has protection. It has this individuality. Individuality means not to divide. You cannot divide anymore. That's what individuality means. Why gastrulation? Because as our friend and recently deceased Louis Wolpert said, the most important moment in your life is not birth, marriage, or death, but gastrulation. Why is that? Because that is the moment, as again we say, that the mass of cells that has been created by the proliferation of the fertilized egg, it's sort of blended and in an origami game and in a dance of the cells is organized into the body plan, and you can see the sketch of the organism through gastrulation, and that's why gastrulation is so important. The idea, I mean, this sort of, the words here, the committee of Mary Warnock wrestled a lot with words and with what is an embryo. Are these early divisions, are they embryos or are they just cells? The term embryo is applied without any problem to these early stages. I disagree with that, but it doesn't matter. The problem and the importance of the words in this game was recently brought into light with this decision of the Alabama court that any... what you do, you fertilize the embryos and then you keep them in nitrogen tanks in case there is a failure in the ones you implant, or in case people want to have other children later. And there are actually in the world right now, there are millions of fertilized eggs waiting in tanks like this. And in Alabama, they decided that every fertilized egg that it's in a nitrogen tank, it's a baby. We are not just talking about an embryo, we're talking about a baby. So that was very surprising, and indeed, as you can see here, I mean, embryos are people, and it won't stop there. And this created a big problem, because in Alabama, a lot of IVF clinics have closed. And of course, this has a lot of important consequences for research. If we want to work with these embryos, and it's very difficult to do that in the States, you know, this kind of very conservative and aggressive movements matter. The in vitro fertilization, the work, and sometimes, as I say, it's very easy to forget that all this biology that we can do today stems from the work of Edwards, Purdy, and Steptoe. And one of the things that is being used is the ability to grow these embryos in vitro, the fact that all cells can give rise to the embryo. This is being used to do a cellular biopsy and do genetic diagnosis to determine whether the embryo before implantation has some kind of defect and therefore it shouldn't be implanted, and this all comes here. And of course, the next step that you can do is do the kind of CRISPR and genetic modification. And this was attempted in a rather harsh and crude way of doing by Jiang Kui, as you all know. He created a big stir with this attempt to edit babies. I mean, he sort of threw that into the world, and people got a bit overexcited about this, and you can see. I think he was ahead of everybody else and did it very, very badly. In fact, it became clear that he had botched up the experiment, that the kind of modification which had to do with HIV was not what he wanted to do. He sprang it to the world without ever being announced. And you know, of course, I think one of the problems of this field, I see it is a problem, be that this genetic modification, the embryos, things that we'll see later, is this hype. This hype, which I think... it's a fit for the kind of society, particularly in America, in which we live, which is populist, and I think we have to be careful with all these hypes. You know, the dawn of the designer baby. And I think the problem with the genetic modification, I think people, the people that were leading the field of the CRISPR were aware of this. They just were being cautious. This happens all the time. Some of us are being cautious in the way we develop the field, but other people jump and thwart the efforts that we are doing, because you have to carry the public in this situation. The problem with editing an embryo so early is that you're going to change the germline. And if you change the germline, you are affecting evolution in many different ways. So once they realized this, that this had happened, the people leading the field, they set up a moratorium completely to avoid the genome modification of embryos. And now we found ourselves all of a sudden with two different kinds of bands that were preventing our understanding of human embryos. One is the day 14 rule, which does not allow us to work with those embryos to move forward from into the territory of the most interesting moments of human development. And of course, the inability of working with genetic modifications in very early embryos, which under certain conditions could help us understand that moment before implantation. So why do we still, and still, the needs to understand human development proceed not only because of what I've mentioned earlier about the lack of the decrease of fertility over the last few years, but also the fact that only about 30% of the conceptions actually make it to term. And this is irrespective of whether it is IVF or natural. The rate is, I'm told by experts that in vitro fertilization, by looking at the embryos, by learning about them, it's improving up to 50%, but in most places it continues to be that. And of the ones that actually develop, of that third that develop, many of them had pathologies. So what can be done? I mean, one of the things that has been proposed is to change the 14-day rule and extend it. And many people are asking to extend it to 28 days at the moment. I actually don't mind. This is an example of the kind of embryos that people grow until the day 14 in vitro. These are embryos that are discarded from in vitro fertilization. And this is the kind of structure that they obtain. I have to say that this has nothing to do with what an embryo looks like. I think one of the problems of extending this line, which I'm in favor of, I think it might lead to a lot of statements. This is not an embryo. I also, as I've tried to point out to people, I've told you that 50% of the blastocysts will not implant well, and that 50% of those who implant are going to have problems. So when you grow these embryos in vitro and you get these masses, is this a problem with your experimental technique, or is this a problem that you are working with an embryo that is damaged? I think these are issues that the field should advance. So in many ways, I'm not sure that we're going to advance a lot if we want to move forward by allowing us to grow, which, as I say, I'm very happy with, to extend the growth of this, the culture of this in vitro systems, because we have a lot of technical problems and problems intrinsic to the biology of those early embryos. The solution exists in the embryonic stem cells, and I think you'll be hearing about that later today, and we'll discuss a lot this afternoon. Embryonic stem cells, there are two kinds. There are cells that are derived from very early blastocysts and have the potential of developing into any cell type of the organism. And as you will hear also later from Barbara, they have the possibility of creating structures that resemble fetal brains and even more. But embryonic stem cells have been a very good source of information about what happens during early development. And from the point of view of regenerative medicine, of maybe creating organs that could be transplanted into situations where there are problems, the induced pluripotent stem cells, which is to revert a differentiated cell back into an embryonic stem cells, have circumvented a lot of the ethical problems of having to destroy an embryo to get embryonic stem cells. A lot of our studies of human biology start with the mouse, and indeed, work in the mouse led to a number of labs, including ours, to work with stem cells. These are the blastocyst has three particular layers, and I think you'll be hearing a lot about that later today from Jacob. That's where the embryo lies. The embryo is surrounded by a layer of cells which is called the trophoectoderm that will give rise to the placenta, and this green light, which is the primitive endoderm that will give rise to the yolk sac, which works as a feeding system for the embryo until the placenta takes over midway through gestation. Embryonic stem cells have been derived from the three components of the blastocyst, and that has allowed people to playing with conditions in, I feel, sometimes somewhat alchemic way, to generate structures of different stages that resemble embryos. And as I said, I mean, my colleague Naomi would have talked about gastroloids. I will talk about them in a minute, and I'm sure Jacob will deal with these things. Having worked all this with the mouse, and this work has been I think to me it raises a lot of interesting questions. It's not just to build embryos because we want to build embryos, it's to try to learn things from embryos. But of course the question arises, can we do the same with humans? And that is something that we would like to do. The problem, again, with changing the focus from the mouse to the human is that it raises the same questions. I mean, are we going to get to a scenario in which we are building a la Frankenstein? Are we going to work as Brave New World, something that Denis has discussed in the lectures within his course? Or are we also going to be playing with genetic selection and genetic modification? These are questions that cannot be avoided, but also should not stop us from going forward and doing sort of developing these techniques. But in present situations, Frankenstein, you know, we could reinterpret it, but Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, is very relevant to the ability of creating this ectogenesis in vitro and the consequences that might have. Personally, I think we are a bit far away from that, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't think about it. And indeed, driven by curiosity, another of the participants this afternoon, Nicolas Ribron, I hope that he'll tell you a little bit, they've managed to, out of stem cells, reconstruct the equivalent of a blastocyst. They called it a blastoid, and they are blastocyst state chambers. And as you can see, the important thing of this system is that it can be produced en masse in very large quantities. These abilities of the cells to self-organize in these structures is very striking. And some of us are very intrigued by them because we can learn something about these systems, and I'll be happy to discuss the details with you. Why, and I hope that Nicolas will be talking this afternoon a little bit more about this, why is he wanting to generate these structures which are remarkably like a human blastocyst? Apart from the fact that it allows us to study things. One of the very important points, as I've made of human reproductive biology, is problems at implantation. A lot of the blastocysts do not implant properly. So maybe this can create an in vitro system to study implantation. I think at the moment, you might think that you've generated something that looked like a blastocyst, you should put it into a womb and it should go on. I mean, this is going to be something I feel that is going to happen in the future, but for the moment, the uterus seems to be able to distinguish between a natural blastocyst and an in vitro blastocyst, and I think this raises a number of questions. Nonetheless, Nicolas has developed a number of systems, in vitro systems, that allow to study some of the early stages of implantation, and I think that might allow one day to develop and to understand the issues of implantation which affect in vitro fertilization and natural reproduction. But what about gastrulation? Gastrulation is important because, you know, if the ones that implant, then they start gastrulating, and as I've said, although they develop to term, many of them, but a lot of them have pathologies. And many years of embryology, of medical embryology, have shown that the origin of a lot of the pathologies that affect the birth of babies map to gastrulation. This is something that sometimes this field completely seems to forget, the field of the stem cells, that there is a lot of history of medical embryology. They like to talk about gastrulation as the black box of human development. There is no black box. We know a lot about the embryology of gastrulation. People might ignore that, but that doesn't mean that we don't know. What is gastrulation? Well, a lot of what we know about gastrulation in mammals is derived from the mouse, and I just want to show you this very little slide because it shows the beauty of gastrulation. In the mouse, the human does start also with about 300-400 cells. In the course in the mouse of a day, in the course of a human in a week, those 400 cells sort of amplify anomalies. This is a beautiful movie from Kate McDowell of gastrulation in the mouse. She was able to capture this, and you can see that it's not only an increased in cell mass, but it's also a choreography in a space of that cell mass. And importantly, the cells seem to acquire a coordinate systems that will transform what is a mass of cells that are disorientated into a map of an organism. That is the project of gastrulation. But as far as you can see, there is an incredible growth. And what interests me is that during this growth, not only hundreds of cell fates are being assigned, but they are assigned with regard to a mysterious coordinate system that is there and allows those cell fates that are being organized to be positioned in a space in a manner that will allow the organism to develop. can we reconstruct this process in a dish with stem cells? Well, I think the reason for this starts with these papers of the very early notes of the early 2000s, in which some people using stem cells, they showed that in vitro, in culture, you could recapitulate some of the cell fate assignments that happened during gastrulation. So that's the primitive streak, which is the iconic element of gastrulation in any vertebrate. And there is a very big order in the way the cells come out of that position in the embryo and become different parts of the embryo. And these people in the States, they showed that in vitro, these cells put in vitro and applied signals that mimic what the embryo is seeing at the time could get a similar order and similar fates. And during many years, we and others did show in vitro that indeed you can direct these cells playing with cocktails of signals to particular fates and use them to either generate the precursors of different organs and either to use them to toxicity. This field is now very active, and over the last few years, this is generating the cells, nothing to do with space. And indeed, for example, a company called Blue Rock has just got very important information that will allow a treatment for Parkinson based on these kind of diseases. And of course, Doug Melton seems to have one for diabetes. But can we, these cells, that doesn't mean that there is an organ, can these be reconstructed? Can we reconstruct the organism? And, you know, a few years ago, as Denis had shown, and what we asked, if these cells in the dish could generate all these fates, could we get them to create three-dimensional structures that mimic these cells? So playing with what we had learned from the development in adherent culture and the idea that maybe if we put them in 3D, something might happen, and using a certain protocol, we were very surprised that after 5 days in culture, you get these structures. They look strange to you. If you're an embryologist, you could recognize some features of embryos, but the most interesting thing to me was that they all look the same. And they all look the same in an interesting manner. And when that happens, there must be a reason and there must be something. What was happening? You can see here a little movie, cells become aggregated, and then what you have here is some cells that carry a reporter brachyury. Brachyury is a gene that determines when it appears your anteroposterior direction, it becomes localized to the posterior, and you will see that is posterior. What was very crucial for this experiment, apart from applying the kind of alchemy that is associated with adherent culture, is the starting number of cells. And this we find still very spectacular. It's what the Americans like to call in a strange manner the Goldilocks principle. We have to put a very precise number of cells. If you go either way, the system doesn't work. And it's about 300 cells, which, as I told you, is about the number of cells that exist in the embryo. And you can see here, I hope that I don't disturb it now. No, I was going to show that maybe I can do it here. No. Anyway, what you would see in this picture, no, it's that the structure would elongate. I'm going to try it again. No. Well, anyway, what happens, you would see the structure elongating. When we started to look at those structures that didn't seem to have anything in the middle, we're starting to see that they had an organization of gene expression that mimicked the embryo, not only just in the anteroposterior direction, but they also had the dorsoventral. In fact, those 300 cells had generated the same coordinate system as the embryo and had arranged a number of the primordia in the way of the embryo. Work that we did with the laboratories of Denis and Matthias Lutolf, led by Leonardo Beccari and Naomi, who has been here, allowed us to look in great detail at not only there was this thing, but when we started to look at different genes, that coordinate system was reflected by the genes in a manner that again reflected the embryos, and not only in a space, but we also see it in terms of time, and we see the maturation of the different tissues. One thing about these structures is that they like the brain, but I'm not going to get into that. So what had we learned from these structures? What were we learning? Well, they look different from embryos, and I think that was also interesting to us. In fact, we do know that they lack the brain, and they represent part of the axial extension. But as I said, some of us are doing these structures to learn something about how cells in embryos, and what we are learning is that embryonic stem cells have the potential to self-organize axial organization. If you read textbooks about developmental biology, they will tell you that in the mammals, it is the extraembryonic tissues that are orienting the embryo. We have seen that there is an intrinsic ability of the embryonic cells to do this, and that what the extraembryonic tissues are doing is biasing that internal cell, intrinsic self-organization of the embryonic cells. Happy to answer more about this later. Cell fate assignments are independent of morphogenesis. The difference between these two individuals here is that if you were to look at the expression of genes in this structure, it would map the expression of genes here. But this lacks morphogenesis, the part of the embryo that gives shape to those cells. So genes by themselves do not determine shape. There is something else. We have a way of inducing morphogenesis here, and we'll mention about it later. We also are learning that I think cell fate assignments, in my mind, create programs, and morphogenesis creates space. So cells, genes create time, and cells create space. We also have the importance of starting conditions. We have the embryo is very modular. The numbers of cells matter. This is something that intrigues us a great deal. Happy to answer questions and talk later. And really, gastroloids are a tool, that's the way we see it, to investigate how cells, that the way I see it, build embryos and dig into the relationship between cells and genes. This is the most important thing to me and where I'm having fun. I like to use gastroloids as a blackboard where I play and I do with conditions, particularly because we can produce them in large numbers. I think it's so the blastoids, those are the two systems that we can produce in large numbers, and they are reproducible, and therefore that's what science is about. The blastoids allow us to explore the pre-implantation. Gastroloids allows us to do the perigastrulation. I think Jacob will be filling that gap in between the implantation and the gastrulation. But once we sort of felt confident that the mouse gastroloids were working, that we were learning something, the natural thing was to try to extrapolate them to human. And indeed, what we did was to play with the conditions. I'm not going to bore you with the details. Sometimes it's very boring. But as they say in England, there was method in the madness. When you read some of these protocols, don't think that they are completely random. And indeed, and this was largely the work of Naomi. We managed to get. And to me, this reproducibility is very, very important. What you see there in blue is brachyury, and in green is SOX2, for those of you who are interested. But again, we managed to get these structures, and when we look in detail, that was we realized that over time they recapitulated the events. We don't know anything about humans, but recapitulated the events in a way that they had gone through gastrulation without the morphogenesis. Happy to discuss that. But again, the organization of the genes was very much the one that happens in the embryo. And indeed, linking up with Alexander van Oudenaarden in the Ubrecht Institute, we looked at the organization of the genome in the gastroloid through a technique derived from Wilhelm Hess in a way, which is to cut the gastroloid in slices with a microtome and then subject each of the slices to a whole genome sequencing. And that allows us to see the organization of the genome in different parts of the gastroloid. And indeed, we see an organization that, barring the brain, is very similar to embryos. This was very remarkable. But remember, these are very small objects, but remember that a human embryo is not much smaller at a similar time, okay? This is sometimes thing, but is it so small? I just think we are not used to thinking about embryos. We think about fetuses, but embryos are very small, as I've shown you embryos, and it's remarkable the organization in the gene expression. What do these gastroloids represent? Well, we notice that there was a signature of a process called somitogenesis. Somitogenesis gives rise to the blocks of tissues that will give rise to your muscles along the body axis and the skeleton. And that allowed us, by looking at the Carnegie collection, which is very detailed in terms of stages, that allows us to realize we see a moment in the gastroloid development where there is no somitogenesis signature, another one that there is, and that allowed us to put the gastroloids at a time that is about Carnegie stage 9, which is about 19 days of development, 19, 20 days of human development. This is all very, very, it raises a lot of questions. These things go through gastrulation without having gone through a blastocyst. If you thought that biology was intuitive, I think this questions a great deal. Still, you might ask, how do we know that what is happening here resembles what's happening in the embryo. We were very lucky that the group of Shankar Srinivas in Oxford managed to get hold of a gastrulating embryo. There was a recent one from China that we haven't yet analyzed, but this was analyzed. They did single-cell RNA-seq, something that you will hear quite a bit about this morning, which is a way of taking single cells and seeing what genes are expressed, and that allows you to get an idea of the complexity of the system. But they didn't have a spatial organization, but I've shown you we have a spatial organization of the genes. So these people did a correlation. They tried to map the genes that they had obtained from a gastrulating embryo with our sort of map of the spatial organization of the genome, and things came out very well. They could find every one of the genes that they had in their map in our gastrulate, and that allowed them to map them in a manner that made sense. There are differences with the mouse, and those differences are important, but for that first we need to establish, and I think we need more work, that there is a correlation between what we see in the gastrulate and what we see in the... This is to highlight that this is the beat of the embryo, this is a human embryo after gastrulation, and this is a gastrulate, and we think that that is the correspondence. What about morphogenesis, and what can we read from it? Well, as I told you, it's quite interesting that there is no this kind of gene expression that's not manifest into morphology, but by putting the gastrulates in this magic powder that is Matrigel, I think always in the world of organoids, I feel that there is like Tinkerbell powder. Remember Tinkerbell in Peter Pan, it allows you to fly. There is Tinkerbell powder in gas in the organoid field, and Matrigel and Wnt are the two magic components of the Tinkerbell powder. And when we put the gastrulates in Matrigel with Wnt, you get this structure that start resembling the trunk with some idea. This is work that we did first with Susan van den Brink and later in human. That's what I'm showing you there with the laboratory of Chanta Salef. And you can see here the emergence of this morphogenesis that now it starts looking like an embryo, and I'm probably not gonna do it here, I hope. But oh yes, it works now. There is the, are we in Switzerland? The situation. So what do we use this for? I think there is a lot of defects of the vertebral column that are related probably to the process of somitogenesis. And using these in vitro systems, we were able of mapping some of these, not of course the full disease, but to show as a proof of principle that by introducing mutations in the ES cells that generate gastrulates that mimic some of the mutations that generate these disturbances, we can see changes in some of the variables of the system that maybe we can use these systems to study disease. One of the things that is very remarkable about these systems, this I think Jacob will be talking, I've told you about the others, Jacob will be telling you about this. What is the most many surprising things that we didn't expect? But one of them is this ability to jump. Systems have the ability to go from ES cells to particular structures without passing by the other stages that previous. And I think this is something that we will need to think about and see how it affects a lot of what we think. So I really want to finish, to wrap up by reminding you that we've gone from a situation where a human embryo was an object of curiosity first, then study later, and over time it's become an icon, but also it's become a tool to improve the conditions of the human being. And even more so, and I think this is something that we're going to see in different shades and colors during the day, it's also the embryo as a subject of study has got to very interesting and intriguing reviews, views of the embryo. And of course, it opened up for situations that lead to dystopian views that we shall have to think about. So I want to thank you for your attention, but I also want to thank people that over the years have contributed to the world, collaborations to the work that we've had, my lab in Barcelona, and this is people with whom I've been discussing a lot of these issues over the last 10 years, particularly with the humans, and I think really appreciate, and a lot of this talk has to do from that discussion. So happy to answer questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alfonso. Questions, comments? Claude.
So you mentioned that symmetry breaking, I mean, is due, can be spontaneously done. But then in vivo it happened because extrahepatic membrane actually induce one axis. Do you think that, so do you have to, does this happen before, or I mean, does the induction by the extrahepatic membrane happens before, or, and you have to wait for getting the auto self-organization?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but I will try to answer it. If I don't answer it, you can tell me. So I think actually this intrinsic self-organization is a property of the epiblast, of the embryonic cells. They are having, but it is put under a lot of constraints by the extraembryonic tissues to make sure that the beginning of gastrulation is orientated with regard to the extraembryonic tissues, okay?
So my question was, I mean, does it happen? It does happen spontaneously, for sure, but I mean, is it on, sorry. Basically the tissue develops, and then at some point you're going to get a signal from the extrahepatic membrane. And if the signal does not occur, then later the axis will form by itself. Is it what the way you describe it?
If you didn't have those signals, the embryo would form, yes. So those signals are not essential to create an embryo. They are essential to orient the embryo with respect to the mother. That's my understanding. That's my belief at the moment.
But do those signals supersede the spontaneous organization, or they just, do it
like
before?
Like everything in biology, I think we are, one of the things I've learned, I get the impression that there are many things that we think are causal in biology. One follows the other, when actually they are happening at the same time, and natural selection has brought them together. I don't think there is a causal relationship between one and the other. They are happening at the same time. We can disentangle them with these experimental systems, but they are happening at the same time. In fact, something else, just as a thing, some people tend to associate in a kind of intuitive manner gastrulation with the attachment, because the embryos attach. When you look at mammals, a lot of mammals attach much later after gastrulation. In fact, a horse will attach when it has limb buds. So there is a lot of play. And I think what these in vitro systems are going to allow us is to explore all that.
So my question concerns what is illustrated at the bottom right. You said that patterning in these gastroloids along the AP-DV axis is very similar to what you find in normal embryos. Yet you emphasize that morphogenesis is abnormal in the gastroloid. I mean, it's not like in the wild type.
No, it's
so that led you to conclude that there's something which is not in the genes that is responsible for morphogenesis. I'm curious, what do you think it is?
Well, I think you know, Thomas. I mean,
but I'm curious about
you, and,
what you, think
you
it
and
is.
I have written about the same things, and I think this is one of the most interesting fields at the moment. I mean, that's the question: is why do you need? Why, if you start with 300 cells? You get everything organized. There is information in that number of cells and in the interactions that I think people like you have made hints of what that can be. I think this is a totally new field. What interests us is if you go up by 100 cells, you don't get two axes. If you go up by another 100 cells, you get MS. If you go below by 100 cells, you don't get it. So I think these are influenced, and they are the same cells that in vitro will reproduce in adherent culture, will reproduce the programs in a temporal manner. I think this is where these systems all of a sudden bring up questions that I think are going to be very, very important. I mean, when you look at the organoids, and I'm talking about the adult stem cell organoids, and I played the game, I can line up there organoids from different gastrointestinal tracts. You wouldn't tell them apart. They are all the same, except that they represent different parts of the gastrointestinal tract that are different. Again, if you look at the genes, they would be different, but the morphology is the same, so they are missing some input, which is in the physical properties of the system, which we need to understand and to see how they link. I think it's early days, but it's quite a good time to ask those questions.
Yeah.
Yes, so one important feature of gastrulating embryos is the acquisition of bilateral symmetry.
And in the one position of?
Bilateral symmetry, right? In one of your gene expression pattern, it seems that the gastrulloids have acquired that. Did you look at this?
The left-right, you mean? Yeah. So, but it's interesting, we did that, we described that in the paper with the knee. It's not only there is a midline, but we can see that it's random. And that's interesting because if in the embryo you remove a membrane that is around the embryo, now the left-right becomes randomized. This lack these early influences. So again, we are all the time seeing these physical morphogenetic things, biasing processes that are intrinsic to the cells.
So I'm not familiar with these systems, but what would you need to make a brain? Because you said that you don't have one.
You can. You see, everybody, we were talking about this data. Have you ever asked a mini brain talk, where is the rest of the body? Okay, so when I hear that question, you need a brain. In fact, a brain is the simplest thing to make, because what you don't need is nothing. If you left the cells to their own devices, if you don't do anything, in fact, Mehmet, who is in the audience, can get gastroloids by just suppressing a lot of the signals. Now, what is going to be interesting, and we are playing with that, is you put them together. But that will create a problem. At the moment, I think we are happy with the system because it lacks extraembryonic tissues and it lacks a brain. That doesn't mean there is not an organ and there are no questions, but it simplifies the study.
More questions or comments?
Oh. You a little bit alluded to it. I want to pick your brain just about saying, so you think it's the extraembryonic tissues will basically make something, you know, whatever organization that happens without them less random? When you say, what do you mean when it says it biases or?
So I just didn't want to get to take, so this is my thought, okay? That's a very, so first of all, apart from the yolk sac, you don't need the placenta until very late. I mean, probably in humans it's different, we don't know, but in the mouse, and you know that, of course. I think that a very interesting feature of gastrulation, which has been written in there by evolution, is this order in the sequence of cell fate assignments, okay? And it's interesting that the first assignments that the gastrula makes in the primitive streak are cells that have to burrow into the trophoectoderm to build the allantois and to build the embryonic blood. So you can imagine that it would be very weird if you had a system that would start gastrulation every which way, you know? So I think that this is teleological. If you want, there is a teleology there. In fact, in work that we did with Matthias by Mehmet, who is in the audience, we showed that indeed we can create these epithelial gastruloids, or Mehmet can, and then we can put it with the trophoectoderm, and now you will see everything starting always in the same point. The system collapses very early, we can discuss why, but then we can see that what is a random thing now becomes very focused on the point of the interaction of the interface between the, so I think that it's a teleological reason, but that's my thought.
Any more questions or comment? Well, perhaps I can go for the last one. When you compare the tomosec approach in mouse and human in gastrulates, it looks very similar. However, there are some very few but extremely striking differences in some expression patterns. And do you think it reflects some fundamental differences between these two type of gastrulates, or?
Well, I think for that, so I agree that's why I think the correlation, and we only have n equals one with an embryo, is very important. Because if we show that the patterns that we see correspond to the patterns of the embryo, those differences are meaningful, rather than an artifact. I believe they are meaningful, but we need, because of the system and the way it's working. I should also say that I think it is those differences, and we have some examples already that justify the use of these systems. You cannot learn, the mouse will give you the principles, but if you want to study details, particularly of disease or of the use of certain genes, you have to go to these in vitro systems or alternatives. Why? Take islet-1. This is for the experts. Islet-1 is a gene that in the mouse is absolutely essential for cardiac development, and that's really its main role. There has never been found a mutation in human by any means, and as you might imagine, human geneticists are working very hard, of an association of islet-1 with humans. And yet, islet-1 is absolutely essential for the emergence of the amnion and the initiation of the embryo in humans, which in the mouse has nothing to do with it. So these particular cases, these differences, are going to be important and are the justification sometimes for a study human. You cannot just say, I'm going to make a human because I want to do a Brave New World or a Frankenstein, but I think these are reasons to do that.
Well, thank you very much, Alfonso. I think that was a great introduction to this day. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.